I hope that you've read the book, and if you haven't read the book, I hope that you've at least read part of the book. Tonight we begin with page 59. If you have not read the book, let me turn your attention to the back, at least the back of the newer copy. He offers here what I think is a pretty good summary. Muscle and a Shovel is a true story about a pair of young newlyweds who move to the city to chase the American dream. In the middle of their pursuit, they are befriended by a man who turns their beliefs about God, their church, and their faith upside down. I don't know if you noticed that or not, but he's got a typo there. Beliefs about God, their church. That's interesting that he put a typo in there. But anyway, I guess that's neither here nor there. So you have a lot of different religious groups covered, and you have these two fellows, they're working together. As I said, chapter 8, this is where we announce Sunday that we're going to start. I'm going to highlight some information, I think, on most of the pages and still offer a good bit of time for discussion. He mentions at the top of page 60, we went to the Baptist church the following Sunday. It was filled with the ETC, Easter, Thanksgiving, and Christmas Christians. We could barely find a seat. When you look at this book, there is a lot of information in here that you could put it in the practical category. You could also put it into the this is very common category. And this is one of the things that you find a lot of times when you deal with people who will say, I'm a Christian, or I have a strong belief in God. If you start asking how often they worship or where they worship, all of a sudden it becomes clear that their definition of being a Christian is probably not all that close to your definition of being a Christian. You ask how often they worship, and it's, well, were there Thanksgiving, were there Christmas, were there Easter, and that's about the extent of it. So as you look at what the experience of Shank was, you begin to find that that's very, very common with some other people. He talks about this particular service and says, Reverend, that was the way that the preacher was addressed. We've got a quick question. That's not uncommon. A lot of times preachers are, whether it's by, in today's world, a text, whether it's email, whether it's a phone call, sometimes it's after services, people will say, I've got a question. Now, that happens in almost every realm. Maybe you've got a question for your garbage collector about the day that they're going to pick up, or if you can put out some extra bags, or you've got a question for the restaurant worker, whomever it might be. And as you ask questions, what do you hope to get, or what don't you hope to get, as far as a response?
What I want is the answer.
Hmm?
All
right, sometimes people are looking for an answer which is consistent with their beliefs or consistent with their will. That might be one of the better answers that we can give. What else?
So I go along with what was said there. I think we expect an answer, and probably a little bit more directed towards what the question actually is, some way that we can, whether it's a tract or pamphlet that somebody can hand us or whatever, that certainly would help. But just to throw a quick answer out there and turn your back on somebody, that doesn't.
Yeah, a pertinent answer, a relevant answer, an answer which is at least going to put us into the general realm. It may not answer everything, but at least it heads us in the basic direction we need to go. Anything else? What about the style of the reply we like, or the style of the reply we don't like? All right. Anything else? What do you think about when you're looking at the book? What kind of response did you get from the preacher? Anybody remember? Yeah, it was flippant. It was kind of, oh, man, you know. Now, maybe the guy had some places to be and some things to do and so forth. Maybe he was thinking about another sermon. Maybe there was a big counseling appointment. Who knows? But here you have a fella. He really has a question. And if it was an Easter service, the preacher, in fairness to him, he may have had some other things going on. But still, don't you appreciate if somebody will take an extra minute or two with you? A lot of times to answer that question, if you just try to, and sure enough, I'll be guilty of this, but I'm going to go ahead and lay out at least the way it should be. Somebody stops long enough to, you know, look you in the eye and understand the question and try to answer the question and not just brush you off and say, well, I don't have time for that, or that's too complicated. Now, there might be some questions where you have to say, I'll get you some information. We're going to have to sit down and talk about that because it requires more than a 1 or 2 minute answer. But a lot of times you can give a person a reasonable answer. Even when you're dealing with kids, isn't that true as well? If the child feels like you're not invested enough in them as far as the time, it's not going to go too well. And eventually that child's going to shut down. Thoughts that you have there, Ray?
It seemed like you waited a long enough period of time to ask that question. And he waited till most of the people had left.
Mm-hmm.
But he still didn't get an answer to his question.
I think, as you look at that statement that I didn't read, we waited after services for what seemed like an hour until everyone filed out, and we could get some time alone with the quote-unquote pastor. So yes, it's not like he's at the front of the line trying to get an answer to that question. They've waited for a good while, and the preacher should have taken enough time, at least some time, to sit down and say, this is what I can give you now. If we need more, we can schedule a time and do that, but that's not how it went. Anybody else? So that's one of the fundamental lessons. As we're dealing with people, whether it is a child in the home situation, whether it is a Bible study prospect, try to take a couple extra minutes with people. Make sure that you invest enough time in them. What's the question? When did the Baptist church begin? What, do you think that's a fair question for a Baptist preacher? I mean, if this is your faith, you should be able to tell me when this religious group started. So that should not have been a surprise for this fellow. What's the answer? Well, it's my opinion. Now, for us, that probably just is kind of like the nails on the chalkboard. Don't say that. Don't do that. But for a lot of people, that's what they expect. They're looking for an opinion. They're looking for a judgment from a religious person. And that's exactly what they got on this occasion. Well, it's my opinion that John the Baptist started the Baptist church. He responded in what kind of tone? In a condescending tone. Now, providentially, that was probably good, because that puts this fellow onto a different path, onto a different track, and he finally figures out the truth. But that was a tone he used that conveyed an unspoken message. It told me I was stupid for wasting his precious time with such a rudimentary and trivial question. One of the things that you never want to do in the spiritual realm, and this is true in other realms as well, is you don't want to make people feel stupid. Can you do that? Easily. How can you do that? How can you make people feel really dumb?
Best way to write off is, that's a stupid question.
All right, you might just come right out and say, that's about as dumb as I've ever heard. So, that's one possibility. What else?
Your tone of voice and your facial expression.
Oh, okay.
The inflection you put on it.
All right. How you respond to the question, the inflection, the facial gestures that you have, that would be another way. What else? Make people feel really dumb, Brian?
Make them think, or say something like, well, everybody knows that.
Okay. That would be true as well. You're now being demeaning. Everybody knows. You know, how could you not know that? Those kinds of things. We've said before that if you have that kind of circumstance, put the blame where? If there's any fault with understanding or asking, it's not on you, it's on me as the teacher. It's on me as the communicator. So that would have been a good thing for this fellow to do had he wanted to make his point in a better way. Next paragraph. Didn't appreciate the tone. And we were, of course, Baptists, duh. But I remember how Randall backed up everything he said with the Bible. So he asks what question? Could you help me find that in the Bible? Remember John chapter 12, verse 48? He that rejecteth me receiveth not my sayings, hath one that judgeth him. The word that I spake, the same will do what? Will judge him when? In the last day. So we're accustomed to that. Book, chapter, and verse. Let's go to the Bible. Let's see what it says. And here, the non-Christian has had enough contact with the Christian to realize, book, chapter, and verse, where is that in the Bible? So that's the question. Now, it will shock you. It still shocks me that there are some people in the religious world who have advanced degrees, who have gone to seminary for 4, 6, 8, 12 years, and yet when something comes up, they'll answer just like this guy. My opinion is, my thinking is, well, everybody believes instead of God's word. And that's a serious problem. But for a lot of people, they think he's got this title associated with his name, so his judgment, his opinion must be right. Betty?
Where does it say in my opinion? Now, my book doesn't say that.
No, the old books read differently than the newer books.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's great. We thought we solved one problem, and now we introduce another one. Well, I've got it. It says in my opinion. So it's in the book.
Is that the new book?
Yes, this is the new book.
Yeah. So, like when he called him a pompous, and then it says
expletive.
It says what now in the new one? Explicit?
Expletive.
Yeah. Oh, it goes in and says the word. It doesn't put the dash.
No, it just says what a pompous, and then in parentheses, expletive. All right, well, bear with me then. Like I say, we have uncovered our second landmine as far as this particular class. So If you want a copy of the book, other than what you're using just for class, that's fine. If not, you can let me know when we find these times. But yes, it does specifically say, well, it's my opinion, in the middle of some of the editions that we have. So thanks for that FYI. Okay. He recommends that the non-Christian go back to Matthew chapter 3 and then says what? Hey, I hope you all will come back tonight. He did have enough time to say, come back and return, right? So it's kind of interesting that he was thinking along those lines. He probably was more interested in somebody being a warm body in the pew and seeing the numbers on the rise rather than actually studying the Bible. And that's sad. A lot of times you'll find with people, they have an agenda, and that agenda is not what you need or what's going to be helpful to you. The agenda is, this is what works best for me. So that is really the bottom line. Gary? It would have, and it could have gone much, much differently. They might have been long-term members there had the fellow actually, you know, taken them back to the study or set up another time to discuss things. And even though his answer wouldn't have been maybe as good as what would have been necessary in other circumstances, taking the time might have been enough. And I think that's another worthwhile point. Even if you're not the best defender of the faith, can your actions sometimes offset a lack of knowledge? Yeah. You know, treat people as you want to be treated. So ideally, you have the knowledge and you have the right actions to back it up. But if you're a little short in the one area as far as Bible knowledge, or you need to, you know, come back and talk about some things at a later time, the right attitude will get you far. It's been said that you can call a man a dog and he'll thank you. And I think there's some truth in that. It's all in how it's said and done sometimes.
Somebody, I don't know, who told me a long time ago that if somebody comes to you and says, I've got a problem, there is a problem. Mm-hmm. The fact that they come to you and say, I've got a problem, it's a problem in and of itself, and you need to address it that way. You can carry that over into when somebody comes to you with a question. Most of the time, it may not be a quote-unquote big problem, but they're looking for an answer, and that's a problem to them. Uh-huh. If you treat questions the same way, this person's got a problem, and then proceed from there, that can be helpful.
It can. And you can take a question about something, and the question ultimately becomes insignificant. It's how you handled it. That's what becomes the real issue, and that's really what you have here. He probably didn't really care so much about the Baptist Church. I mean, with the discussion with Randall, I mean, well, okay, but and we'll see that in the subsequent pages, that how the preacher responded was the thing that really got the ball moving, and that can be true for us.
And, you know, he asked the question, they were at the Baptist church, why didn't the preacher get the Bible out and say, look here in Matthew
yeah.
and read it to him?
Yeah.
I never understood it the way he acted.
It is. It's very strange. I mean, you would think that if he knew where the passage was, everybody's gone home. You know, Easter dinner can wait a couple more minutes. So here's Matthew chapter 3. Answer the question, go on. And more than likely he would have been satisfied and gone home. But because he, going back to Stan's point, because he acted in that way, now a whole new issue has been opened up. And that's where the attention is going to be focused. And that's what happened. So there are some things that are fairly predictable when it comes to human nature. And that's what we see by and large when it comes to the book. Betty? It's very possible. Again, I'm reading between the lines a good bit here.
Yeah, I know.
But when you think about the size of this religious group, I don't think that there's anything in there. But if you've got an assembly, Easter Sunday, generally people want to get out the door because they're headed somewhere, either a restaurant, they've got a reservation. and it's taking an hour to get everybody out, I would assume that that's going to be a fairly large group. And if you have a fairly large group, generally you don't have a new preacher there. You have somebody who's probably been well-educated, somebody who's been preaching for a significant amount of time. And if those things are all true, and like I say, there's a lot of reading between the line, there are several inferences that could be wrong somewhere along the line, he surely had been exposed to that question before. So I don't think he was a newbie by any means. Ray, and then we'll go back to Glenda or whoever started to flash a hand.
The pastor's response there, see, it come back tonight. At this particular point, Mike may have been thinking he just wants more money. I used to attend the Lutheran Church and the Methodist Church, and they took up a contribution for Bible class, worship service, Wednesday nights, Sunday nights. Every time you come in the door, there was a contribution. And that's kind of what I'm seeing here for Mr. Mike, that he's aware of that. Really has that hit on the nose. He's looking for money.
That is true. And like I say, come back Sunday night. I don't know if there was a Sunday evening collection. I've not heard of a religious group hitting their people up all those times, but that's an interesting detail.
That did happen. Two different congregations that I was in. Lutheran and Methodist.
Very interesting. Glenda, did you start to flash a hand, or there was somebody back there? I'm not sure who it was. Let's continue. You get onto the pompous expletive. You can kind of fill in the blank as far as what that was. Moving down to the next full paragraph, he says, yeah, and just think that one. But he doesn't have the time to open the Bible when confronted with an honest Bible question. Now, he's angry. He's upset. We can understand that. But I think we can also look at this and think that's probably going to be the reaction of a lot of people. It doesn't have to be a Bible question. Almost any question, if you are treated in this way, you're put off, might be a work situation, might be a child in the home, you feel like, he really didn't care, she didn't have time with me, they're not really that concerned about me. Moving down to about mid-page, he said, churches were becoming all about the money with their multi-million dollar worship facilities. Then those churches seemed to be replacing the Bible content for bigger buildings and better entertainment. Why? To draw bigger crowds, of course. Bigger crowds meant bigger donations. Bigger donations meant bigger paychecks, better lifestyles for the leadership of those churches. Two quick points here. In 3 John 7, John said we took nothing of the Gentiles. That is, when it came to funding the work of the church, John said we funded that from fellow Christians, we funded that internally. That's a biblical example. That's the example that we need to follow. But when you look at a lot of religious groups, they don't do that. They will take money from any source that they can get it. I assume that from what's here, that they were members of the Baptist Church. I mean, he does make a point about them being Baptists. I don't know that they were specifically members of this Baptist Church, but that seems likely. Maybe I'm just not recalling that detail. But he was convinced that they were looking for cash. And today, there are a lot of people that when they look at preachers or when they look at religious groups, they think they're just out for the money. Preachers are out to fleece people. Preachers are rich. And it's just all peaches and cream. Well, I'm very happy with my job, with my occupation. I don't count myself as being a quote-unquote rich preacher. I'm certainly not in the six-figure salary category, and that's fine. But I have had a few people over the years, and I think any preacher who has preached for a while will probably have this same experience you will have if you're a preacher. At some point, someone come up and say, you're in it for the money. Now, one of the responses that I've given to that over the years is, well, the water's fine, come on in. If you think the work is nothing but a couple of quick sermons on Sunday and maybe teaching a Bible class or two each week, come on in. There are plenty of openings. In fact, Ray and I were at a preacher's meeting yesterday, and there are about five openings within probably a 70-mile radius of here. So if you think that the money is that easy, and I'm not talking to the class, I'm just talking in general, there are a lot of places out there that can use a preacher. But people, we wouldn't want to do that, and this, that, and the other thing. But it's interesting that that is sometimes the perception. Looking down at the bottom, he mentions, weren't bigger church buildings designed to appeal to the lust of the eye and impress the people with money? There's some truth in that observation. If you think back to Mark Reynolds, remember when he was here some time ago, he showed the slides from India, the donations, which would be kind of like what Ray said, you come, and they're always after more money. And they're making their idols, they're making their fancy religious buildings, and the fancier they are, the more people come. Or at least that's what they typically experience. Page 62, a few points from there as well. He said it was becoming all about money. TV preachers were raking in millions from little old ladies living on fixed poverty level incomes while they live the lifestyles of sheiks. That's true as well, and that is certainly a problem. There have been at least a few congressional investigations where some of these fellows, Robert Tilton from Texas, was investigated several years ago. And if you go out and look, Oral Roberts, what he did out in Oklahoma, and you sort of have a list, there's still plenty of guys you can find. They're selling their miracle water, and they'll send you out the healing cloth and all those kinds of things for a donation. So certainly money is something that has been... Well, in fact, Paul talked about that, that some would use godliness as a way of gain, and that's true. There have been some people who have been hawking religion for a long time, but that's not what we deal with when we are talking about New Testament Christianity. In the next paragraph on page 62, he says, however, greed, materialism, and the gospel of money in the church didn't live well with me. And that's true for most folks. When you begin to look at the health and wealth gospel, people say, send in a donation and you're going to be rich. Send in a donation and you're going to be well. And that doesn't work out. You know, we've talked about this before, but the sheer odds, if you play the lottery with 500,000 other people, do you think somebody's probably going to win? All right, yeah. Some number is probably going to come up, or maybe multiple numbers come up. So you do have some winning. And if you're out there saying, okay, send in the donation and you're going to have health, or you're going to get a refund check from your insurance company, or the IRS is going to send you something, or you're going to get a refund from your health insurance company, just the sheer odds will work in your favor. There will be some people who send in a donation, and the way things went, there will be some people that will get better. There will be some people who pick up a financial windfall. Maybe it's an inheritance of some type, and then they're able to use that to continue to fleece people. Then let's read that next paragraph. It's about halfway down on page 62. To top it off, arrogant pastors who lived large from the donations of the church disgusted me. Hey, if a guy wants to make the big bucks in the land of the free and the home of the brave, then by all means, he should knock himself out trying. The private sector is a place for him, and the free enterprise system is the perfect financial vehicle. Nevertheless, preachers, pastors, and evangelists who lived upscale, materialistic, six-figure lifestyles, lifestyles created and maintained by donations, were a sickening and vile breed whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, whose glory is their shame, and whose minds are earthly things. The Bible says, 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 3, through covetousness their great desires, shall they with feigned works or slick speech make merchandise of you, make money off of you, is the idea there, whose judgment now of a long time lingereth not, and their damnation slumbereth not. And then he says, hey, Mr. Rolex-wearing, Mercedes-driving, slick-talking pastor, you won't make merchandise of me any longer. Now, some thoughtful guys have given consideration to even the vehicles that they drive. I've got a good friend of mine. He is a preacher down south. He's been preaching in the state of Tennessee for a long time. Several years ago, he told me he would really like to drive a Cadillac. He's one who really likes luxury, and for him, he thought a Cadillac would be a great car to drive. But he said, I don't think I can get away with it. He said the perception is going to be that, you know, we've got this rich preacher who's out there, and he said, the perception of it would be bad. Now, I guess there are arguments on both sides of the fence. You should be able to drive what you want as far as a vehicle. But if that's going to create some difficulties with some people, whether it's a Bible study prospect or whether that's a Christian, then you probably want to rethink that or maybe rethink your line of work. But if you've got a preacher showing up with a Rolex watch, I've not priced a Rolex. I'm not. Anybody know what they run? Okay. Anybody know about where they start? A Rolex? How much? All right. So there is a cheapie. So let's just say you've got a $5,000 Rolex watch and you come up in your Mercedes. And a lot of people are probably not going to take that very well. But you're probably going to have a salary that's going to be commensurate with that. You're probably going to be up in the six-figure category. So it's something to keep in mind. You know, I'm not keen on a lot of jewelry. Some people are. But again, that can be a problem as well. You see somebody like Mr. T all decked out, or you see somebody coming in with gold chains, that might be a put-off for some people. And two, I would say that women can fall into that same category. You have Paul, women seem to be overdressing in 1 Timothy chapter 2, that was an issue. So again, we want to make sure that we're not outside the norm. You know, if you're going to suppose that you are heavy on the perfume, there are some ladies, or maybe it's a guy with a cologne, and I mean, you are the lady that just loves to go ahead and kind of clog yourself in perfume for whatever reason. Well, if you're going to go out in a Bible study, do you think you might want to back that off a little bit that day? Not everybody is all that keen on perfume. So rather than, you know, going out and being a cloud of perfume, maybe you need to go ahead and either wait until you get back or tone that down a little bit. So think about that as you deal with people. Thoughts that you have as we finish up this chapter. Stan?
Well, I can understand Michael being disappointed that he didn't get an answer here, but it seemed to me like he overreacted to the importance of the question. And so I started thinking to myself what was happening here. And I think one of the things that we'll have to, that we would have to know, and is a good lesson in a way, he was getting it from both ends, actually. It wasn't just a curiosity question. He had Randall on one side of him, urging him to find out these things and get these answers. And so he went to this pastor with more than just a curiosity question. It was something he really wanted to know. And so I think that could be one of the reasons why it really aggravated him. Well, when somebody comes to us with a question, we, most of the time, are not going to know what the background is for that question. And so at least your initial response needs to be gauged in such a way that you don't trigger what this man triggered in Michael's mind.
Yeah, take it seriously, because when it might be just, this is a question, I'm not really that concerned about it. It's just kind of an idle matter to me, and you're convenient, I thought I might ask. Or it might be here, where it really is someone who's waffling between two positions. And as you look at that last statement on page 63, the last sentence, he said, I had to fight Randall with Bible knowledge. Maybe Matthew 3 was the place to start. So he was looking for something. The Baptist preacher gave him a scrap, and he thought, well, okay, I'll check it out and see how it works. All right, moving then into chapter 9, interesting title, Lower Than a Pregnant Ant. Page 66, his wife made a nice Sunday lunch, and they get back to the apartment, and then he says what? I did what when it came to Matthew chapter 3? I searched. Well, don't we find that in the Bible? Acts 17:11. Now, these were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind, examining the scriptures how often? Daily, whether these things were so. There is that good and honest heart that will actually try to search out the scriptures. They may not know a lot. They may not have the best tools, but they will try to check it out. Here is a fellow. He's got some information from the Baptist preacher. He's got a passage. So now it makes sense. I have a brain. I have a Bible. So I'm going to take my brain and my Bible, sit down, read through it, and see if I can find what that preacher discussed with me. All right, so he starts looking at that, eats lunch with a long face. The wife says, what's wrong? He says, the chapter that pompous, you're back to the expletive, recommended says nothing about John starting the Baptist church. An honest man goes through the chapter, reads it, and he can't find the information. I think most of us have probably been in that situation before. Somebody says, well, it's over there, or it's in there as far as this chapter of the book. And we look, we search, we read, we study, we check it four or five times, and finally we come back and we say, it is not there. I have looked every which way, and I know it's not there. So the wife thought for a while as she chewed, what does it say? Well, then you have that highlighted. The text speaks of John the Baptist, but it's a description of what? Of his activities. It is not a proper name. Matthew 3:6 says people were coming to him from Judea and were being baptized by him in the Jordan River. It doesn't say he started the Baptist church or what? Or any church at all. So, yes, John was important. Yes, John did some baptizing, but he was not the founder of any religious group. Well, again, you can see the logical thought process. The wife, trying to be helpful, says what? Well, maybe the preacher made a mistake. Now, if you really wanted to know, even though it was Easter dinner, you might call him up and say, was it really Matthew 3? Or send him a note and say, could you get back with me sometime soon, perhaps tomorrow, and let me know if this is the chapter or if you have some additional references. So he tries to be generous. He says, maybe read a little bit more tonight. Then let's look at that next paragraph at the bottom of page 66. Coincidentally, or perhaps providentially, many of my repair calls during the following week came from my Baptist church accounts. So I took advantage of the situation and asked the various Baptist preachers the same question. Now, this happens with people. We've had some visitors here over the years who have said, we've been talking to religious groups in the area, we've been talking to some preachers, and I've been asking them this question. What's your answer? How do you see this? What's your opinion? What's your judgment? And that is one way that people have found the truth. They're getting different things. We do that too sometimes, don't we? What's the circumstance where you go out and talk to different people? You're asking the same basic question of different folks.
What? Making a major purchase?
All right. It might be a major purchase. You're looking for a new refrigerator. So you talk to, you know, maybe go to Sears and Lowe's and H.H. Gregg, and you check out the different salespeople and the different items. You're trying to make an evaluation. When else does that occur?
Census.
All right. Census would be another good one. That wasn't what was coming to my mind. Anything else?
A big medical decision.
All right, second opinion, or sometimes a second opinion is not enough. Before somebody cuts on you, opens you up, before they start some kind of aggressive treatment, multiple opinions. What about a quote? You're going to have a new roof put on. Unless you're really confident about the roofer, do you go out and get two or three or maybe four or five estimates? Sure. So it makes sense to talk to multiple people. And that principle in the secular realm is often transferred over into the spiritual realm. All right. So he has a lot of these accounts. He's talking to the Baptist preachers, asking this question. Who started the Baptist church? Now, that would seem to be a really easy question, wouldn't it? I would think that that would be something they could say right off the bat. This is it. And then you find that he received varying responses. Some said John the Baptist. Some said the Baptist church came out of the Catholic church during the Reformation movement. Some said the Baptist church was part of the Church of the Bible. And then you get this goodie. Some were not sure when or where it began. Now, can you imagine going to a preacher and asking, when did your church begin? Well, I don't know. We're just here. That begins to continue to sow some of the seeds of doubt. He says, one thing was clear. None of them could provide any scriptural support to prove that the Baptist church was the church in the Bible or that it was a part of the church in the Bible. And as Stan mentioned earlier, that frustration, that's now being fueled. The Baptist experience that he had was not good. Now he asks more and more, and it's not working up. Remember what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount? He said, ask and seek and ask, seek. What's number three? Knock. Sometimes it's not enough to ask. Sometimes it's not enough to seek. But if you're willing to ask and seek and you're willing to knock, Jesus said that door is going to be open. And that's finally what happens to him. But there are a lot of things about Christianity. They're not always easy. Persistence is often required, sometimes even to become a Christian. Top of 67, later that week, Randall met me coming through the back door of OSI with his Bible in hand. I cut him off. He said, I don't want to argue. But Randall replied, Mr. Mike, it's my Christian duty to come to you and apologize for offending you. I was floored. I'd yelled at Randall during the previous week for no reason other than pressing him into verbalizing his personal convictions, and he was the one who was apologizing. Now, you may have different ideas about this. Maybe he felt like an apology was necessary. I don't see any difficulty with that. I'm not sure at this juncture Matthew 5, 23 and 24 would have been a passage that I would have rolled out. But again, that's the way he did it, and that seems to have worked out very well. But the critical point here, in my estimation, is how is he dealing with a non-Christian? Sensitive to the questions, and now he says, you might have been offended, so what am I willing to do? I'm willing to apologize. When you look at people in the world, how tough is it to get an apology sometimes? Man, there are some people, they will dig in and they will not apologize. They could be in the wrong, and everybody might say that they were in the wrong. Maybe there's a picture or there's other information, excellent proof to show that they were in the wrong, but that pride prevents them from acknowledging the need for an apology. And they just dig in like an old mule and they will not back up. But here you have this work situation and the non-Christian thinks that, you know, you really didn't need to apologize, but here you are coming. And that's one more thing that stands out about this guy. He goes to the Bible and he's now trying to live by the Bible. I'm truly sorry if I've offended you in any way. Will you please forgive me? And here's where you get to the pregnant aunt. He says, I was ashamed of myself. I felt lower than a pregnant aunt. And made the admission, you don't need to be forgiven of anything. Anything that you want to add or ask? Okay. Let's skip the page and go over to 68. Again, he turns him back to the Bible, this time Matthew chapter 16, verses 13 through 18. It's now time to discuss the establishment of the church. You have information here about the Lord coming to the coasts of Caesarea Philippi. The disciples were asked who Jesus was, what people were saying about him. Some said, "We hear that you're being called John the Baptist." Others said, "Elias." Some thought that the Lord was Jeremiah, one of the prophets. And then Jesus asked the disciples, he said, "Who do you say I am?" And then you have Peter speaking up, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered and said, "Blessed art thou, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood hath not revealed it unto thee, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say unto thee that thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." So you have, as that passage is read, some simple observations being given. And this is one of the things that I think is very effective with non-Christians. You can have a passage read and start asking them some simple, basic questions. If you were to turn somebody over to Matthew 16, you could say, "Who built the church?" Christ. If Jesus built the church, who's the founder of it? Christ. Who then makes the rules? Christ. Who's the head of the church? Christ. And how many churches did he build? One. People can see all that stuff. And just as we talked before about writing down the conversion experience of someone before you get knee-deep into the Bible study, on significant passages like this, you might also write down that information. Here's what you said. Jesus is the head of the church. He's the rule maker. He built only one church. And then you have some information as you look here, and you can make some deductions. If Christ built the church, then who didn't build it? John the Baptist or Martin Luther or John Calvin. You can go through the list. And if Jesus is the head of the church, what can we infer from that? If Jesus is the head, then no one else is. And the no one else would include the Pope. Now, they may try to say, well, Jesus is the head of the church in heaven and the Pope is the head of the church on earth. You have two heads? Well, no. Well, who is it? Christ is the one who has all authority, whether it's on heaven, whether it's in heaven, or whether it's on earth. So John the Baptist, never part of the prophecy about building the church, never part of any information concerning owning the church. He never purchased the church. Now sometimes, and this again reflects what you find in a lot of actual Bible studies, you use a word, or you use a word in a certain context, and a person hears that, and to us, it just sounds like, oh, we've heard that a million times. But for that non-Christian, Jesus purchased the church. For a non-Christian, that might sound pretty odd. Jesus bought the church? I mean, he owns everything. How could he purchase a church? Well, where's he go? Acts chapter 20, verse 28. Paul's talking to the elders at Ephesus, and he says, "The church which the Lord purchased with his blood." So when Jesus died on the cross, he purchased the church. And then you have on page 69 at the top, he says, "I've never seen that verse." If you talk to non-Christians, if you study with non-Christians, chances are at some point you will hear those words. "I did not know that verse was in the Bible. I've never read that verse before." Now maybe that's literally true. Or maybe that's not quite true in the sense that they have read it before, but they never read it in that way before. They didn't have the background to understand that verse, to plug it into where it needed to be plugged into. And then as you make some progress, you could cite some of the passages. He mentions Colossians chapter 1, verse 18. Christ is the head of the body. What's the body? The church. Well, if Christ is the head of the body, or he's the head of the church, doesn't that line up with Matthew 16, verse 18? Jesus said, "Who's going to build the church? I'll build the church. Thus, I'm going to be the founder, I'm going to be the head, I'm going to be the ruler maker, I'm going to be the one who is the leader of the body." And then about halfway down, that paragraph says, "I had never seen any of those verses." And then we get to the truth. This is also what you find with a lot of non-Christians. "To be honest, I had never really read that much of the Bible." Big surprise. When you start talking to people at work, in your neighborhoods, even some people who may go to a religious group on a regular basis, if they are brutally honest with you, if you get to the point where you actually start studying the Bible, they may make that same point. "I have never read that much of the Bible. I was one of those people who would read pieces of Scripture during hard times." That's true for a lot of people. When they lose a job, when they're not feeling very well, when they have some problems in the home, marriage, whatever it might be, they'll then go to the Bible, oftentimes the Old Testament, maybe the book of Psalms, maybe the book of Job, and find some consolation there. You also find people doing what you have Mr. Mike doing. Mike. I've got to make sure I keep those guys straight. And that is, they'll take a Bible, think, okay, I need a message from God. So how do they treat the scriptures? Acts 20. Well, there it is. Lo and behold. Sign from God. Remember we cited Acts 20, 28? That's just where it happened to open up. Well, that's just the way it was. God wasn't giving me a special message or anything. It wasn't telling me to head back to Acts 20. But for a lot of people in the religious realm, and maybe even some people in the church, it's almost like a Ouija board. They, you know, this open it up and, you know, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and well, this must be the passage for the day. And that has gotten people into some serious trouble. But as he mentions, that's a fool's approach. About 3/4 of the way down, I'm not really sure, Randall. I replied weakly because I was no longer wrestling with Randall. I was wrestling with my existing beliefs and beginning to see that my beliefs were different than the Bible verses that I was now seeing for the first time in my life. Remember what we know. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is God's power to salvation to everybody that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. This is exactly what we find here. He's coming face to face with God's word, and it is having an effect in his life. Thus, Mr. Mike, you dig into the Bible, and then he says you dig all you want, and you're not going to find some of your convictions, specifically that John the Baptist started the church. You have, as you look at page 70 and 71, some information about Petros, Petra. You may remember that Jesus, when he founded the church, founded on the confession that Christ is the Son of God. Peter was the little stone, the little rock. Jesus, of course, who he is, he's like that big stone, like the Rock of Gibraltar. And people, he mentions Catholics on page 70, that they have the idea that the church was founded on Peter. And that's simply not true from the standpoint of the words that are used, Petros and Petra. It's also the case that you have a difference when it comes to the gender that's used, the feminine and the masculine. So church wasn't built on Peter. Church was not built on John the Baptist. It was built on Christ. And then as you look over on page 71, middle of the page, because in Matthew chapter 14, verse 10, two chapters before Jesus talked about building the church, what happens? John's dead. And yet Jesus, as he talks about building the church, it's in the future. So how could the church be built on a dead man? So that's very, very helpful. So hopefully that's one of the points that you take away from tonight's class. And he sees that. Randall said, that's right, that's right. And then a little bit more on page 71. Oh yeah, the Bible reveals that the church began after Jesus' ascension into heaven and seated at the right hand of God. So we have that on the day of Pentecost. Anything that you want to add or ask? Gary? It is. Not only answer the questions in the right way, but when a person hits a home run, or even if they are headed to first base, encourage them. Yes, that's exactly right. It's not me that taught you. You read the scripture for yourself, and you figured that out. So good for you. Let's see if we can finish up this lesson and then be ready for chapter 10 next week. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. At the top of page 72, the first full paragraph, Mr. Mike, I'm not saying it. The Bible says it. That's also an important point to remember when we're talking to people. It's not what I believe. It's not what our congregation believes. It's not what the preacher believes. This is what you find in the scriptures. And you've read the Bible for yourself. You're understanding it just fine. Randall had made more sense with his worn-out Bible than any preacher that I talked to all week. Now, that says something. But he has the ring of truth. We can sometimes identify truth by the way that it's expressed, it makes sense, it all goes together, and that's what we have here. Jesus alluded to that in John 8, verse 32, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Well now, if the Baptist church wasn't started by John, then what's the natural question? Who did? And that's where his thinking process takes him. And this is interesting. That's not really a Bible question at this point, is it? No. I mean, we know biblically that John didn't do it. So, it came from somewhere else, so where might you go to figure out that information? Yeah, you can go to the public library. In our case, you might pull up the internet. That's something. Why don't you check that out and see what you find? Come and let me know. And then he gives you some of the history there. Baptist Church goes back to the 1600s, 1607 to 1609. And then on page 73, yes, maybe we good-hearted Baptists were just being optimistic. but it was not our denominational optimism that bothered me. It was our ignorance of the word and our lack of biblical support in various claims. Through my personal research, I had found out the John the Baptist origin was, in reality, a lie. Now that hurts. As you see a person begin to uncover spiritual truth, always be sensitive to where they are. You're seeing beliefs being ripped away. You're taking perhaps cherished views, and they're being torn apart from the mind of the person. And that's difficult. Bear in mind, have some sympathy for people. Why did I believe what I believed? It was because how I was raised. I'd never known anything else, and I'd never really studied the Bible. I was angry, but not at Randall. I was angry at myself. I was angry at my ignorance of God's word. And as Jesus said in Matthew 22, verse 29, you do err not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. Why do we make religious mistakes? Because we do not know the scriptures. That is exactly right, and that's true for many, many people.